Marriage is not for everyone. Some people figure that out early in life. Others figure it out once they've been married. Our guest this hour gets us inside her head at a time when she was thinking about an alternative to marriage as she had known it. Melissa Mathewson thought about and talked about an open marriage to considerable resistance initially from her husband. She writes about it in her book, Tracing the Desire Line, a memoir in essays. Melissa Mathewson is something of an essay specialist, with her work published in a number of literary reviews. She's also been awarded several fellowships and residencies. Melissa currently teaches at Southern Oregon University, focusing on professional practice in media writing, social media, and media literacy. Melissa Mathewson, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me today.
So have your published essays been as personal as what you put in your book?
Yes, for the most part, that's been my focus in most of my writing career, is sort of the creative nonfiction personal essay. And so I've always been drawn to that form as a method of expression and creativity.
But it's one thing to write about yourself and one thing to write about your innermost thoughts. So did this get you beyond your comfort zone a bit?
Yeah, I guess you could say. I'm not one to shy away from risk in writing. And I think some of the most compelling writing and literature that's out there is that the writing that really plunges into the deep truths that we all experience as humans. So if I can do that in an artful way and provide that to a reader so that they can have a good reading experience, then I feel like I've succeeded as a writer. So there's definitely some level of discomfort in exposing oneself in a vulnerable way to an audience, but you know, if you think about it too, in memoir, I'm crafting a character, a persona. I'm the narrator, and it's based on truth on my life, but it's also done in an artful way. And so there's a little bit of separation there, I guess, for me when I'm writing about it in that deeply personal way.
So some artistic license, certainly, but I mean, are you conveying the events pretty much as they happened?
Yes, I stick to the truth. You know, in the book, I use a number of different forms for telling the story, and so that's where I feel like the sort of the art and the craft come into it. So I use letters, sometimes I use a different point of view, so I refer to myself in the third person, and that typically was an intentional choice. When I was writing things that were very personal, it felt like a nice choice to write in the third person to be able to really get to the essence of the story and the truth. And then when I went to put it into the book, it just made sense to leave it that way. I liked the way that it kind of came out. The book.
Promo lines for the book, Tracing the Desire Line, talk about opening up your marriage in the sense of actually having an open marriage. That's what you're seeking?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So sort of the pathway to that, you know, my husband and I got married very young. And so I was sort of on this certain path for your life. You know, you think about, okay, I'm going to meet a partner and I'm going to get married and I'm going to have kids and I'm going to get the house and I'm going to have the career. And that's what you're supposed to do. Or that's kind of what I always thought was, you know, where my life was headed. And it wasn't until, you know, 15 years in, after two kids, where I was with a friend who sort of introduced a new sort of alternative relationship to me that sounded interesting. And in my way that I do, which is out of curiosity and research, I started investigating it. And so to me, I started questioning, what is this role of marriage in my life? Do I want to stay married? How can I stay married and have a family, but also explore other relationships? And so that's where the book kind of does that investigation into the nature of monogamy and contemporary marriage. So
it becomes pretty quickly clear to a person reading the book that you are, in fact, sort of walking this line of figuring out where desire leads. But there's also another influence in the title of the book. It's a folk group called the Rural Alberta Advantage and a song called Vulcan Alberta. And here's the key clip.
In my life, I've been about as far as I'll climb, and the winter's hiding our desire line. I'm gonna wake you up, gonna break you out, gonna steal your heart, gonna save you now, gonna try.
So winter's hiding our desire lines is what they sang there. So what is the desire line in your mind?
Yeah, so that's sort of the driving metaphor behind the book. And it was in the preface of the book, I explain it for the reader. But it was, I was a radio DJ at the time that I was in this exploration of my marriage. And so I was playing this song and I heard that term, the desire line. And instantly, because I was on kind of this pathway of looking at my own desires, I did research. I was like, what is a desire line? And the way it's actually used in landscape, but the way I use it in the book is sort of the desire line is the when you're on a path in the forest, it's often those tracks off the beaten track that the deer tracks through the woods that often takes you direct to a point. And then the book, the way I use it is I'm kind of tracing my own path off the main path, which you can the title kind of works in a number of different ways. With most of the chapters in the book have something to do with desire or longing in some way. So you have that in the title, but then you also have this narrator who's kind of going off the beaten path and tracing her own desire line. So that's how it works. And it all started with that song that you just played. So thank you.
Sure, glad to have it. It helps explain a few things, but some wandering off the desire line itself as the book progresses. We'll talk more with Melissa Mathewson. Her book is in fact called Tracing the Desire Line, a memoir in essays. She'll be talking at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland on Thursday evening, October 3rd at 7 p.m. We have her for the rest of the hour. You can join the conversation on The Exchange when we return to talk more with Melissa Mathewson about Tracing the Desire Line in a minute 20. The first words in the book actually are not yours, but those of George Bernard Shaw, and it kind of sets the tone for the book. Can you read those for us, Melissa?
Sure, I'd love to. Okay. When two people are under the influence of the most violent, most insane, most elusive, and most transient of passions, they are required to swear that they will remain in that excited, abnormal, and exhausting condition continuously until death do them part.
Well, there's quite a rumination in the marriage ceremony, but the wedding ceremony. This is where you got then.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of that illusion of the romantic love in those first few years when you're in love with someone that it's going to stay that way forever. And that's sort of the way I feel like, in my opinion, that marriage has kind of been sold to us, whether through film or story or TV and just cultural expectations. And so for me, opening the book in that way gave a sort of signal as to where I was going to go with opening the marriage and my own discovery. So,
your own life, though, as a child, you mentioned some differences. You provide us with some examples there that you went for Halloween at age 5 as a bride, and then you told your mother at age 10 that you'd never get married. What prompted that?
And my mother's probably listening, actually. I grew up, and so I'll be careful here what I say, but it was one of those things as a girl, you idolize princesses, you idolize brides, and I did as a girl, and I didn't really know any better, right? It was like kind of the influence of growing up in the 80s, and that's what I wanted to be, and I didn't know any better. And then when I came out to my mom at the dinner table saying I was never going to get married, I think that sort of came from coming from a family in which my parents had difficulties in their own marriage. And so as witness to that as a young child, I think I kind of had this idea that, no, I'm not going to do this. As I recall, I mean, I was 10 at the time, now 42, as I recall, that was where that came from, I think, was the influence of being part of a family that where marriage was difficult. And so that was sort of what I wanted to do. I think I also had this notion of independence, which has carried me through most of my life as being a fairly independent person. And I didn't think marriage could offer me the independence that I wanted.
How did she respond? I mean, given that she was in a marriage that was not functioning particularly well at that point.
In the memoir, in my memory, she definitely said, oh, you'll, of course you'll get married. Like, it's something that, you know, everyone does. Even though she was having her own tumultuous relationship and marriage, she still insisted that it was something that I would do, which is interesting for me to think about now, that she would encourage me to marry when she had her own troubles in it.
You just raised a point that you had raised earlier about the difference between memory and memoir. They're not necessarily the same thing, are they?
No, I mean, you know, and the way I kind of write and the way I approach memoir and is in fragments, because that's kind of how our memory works, in pieces. And so a lot of the book is told in fragments and stories of fragments. And as a whole, it becomes a memoir in that it's relating experiences from the past. So that's kind of how I see the difference. It was interesting. I was at a book event last week in Bend, and someone said, oh, you know, this could be called a collage in essays because of the nature of the structure of the book. So I thought that was kind of cool to think about it that way as well.
So you do certainly start us off, you know, you break the ice very quickly, obviously, with the George Bernard Shaw quote about how marriage is not for everybody. We're supposed to have it last all these years. But then you do get a little collage. You do get other elements of life in there. And the first essay is actually from October, which seems appropriate. We're sitting here in October.
Right.
You and husband Josh bought a farm in the Applegate Valley, and the descriptions were rather delicious, I thought. If you can read some of that, I'd love to hear it.
Sure, thanks. Okay, I'll read the short excerpt. It starts day length. This stretch of season progresses in decay. The night settles the day sooner and with stars. All of our work slows. The scent of pine and water infuses the air we breathe. It feels like a tonic, so we take time to walk the farm. Everything is seed-heavy, every plant and crop laden with tiny scions of a whole new world, wrapped and hidden in hull and carapace. The fields die back with rot, the bees go, so do the flies. The cold draws out the animals, if only for a moment, temporary, in anticipation of retreat in the blanket of still land. The blue herons appear, harbingers of the coming change, swooping to take their place among the sweep. There are these things, too, the fox on the road with a silver-blue coat, thin and hungry, skunk on the pavement, bear in the pasture, geese in triangles over the farm, the salmon in spawn, the deer soon bedding down for gestation. Every animal collects, stores, roams. The hawk cries, enough of this heat, enough of the dry air.
And there we are in October, the first of the essays in Melissa Mathewson's book, Tracing the Desire Line, a memoir in essays. So had you been country people before? I mean, you're really in getting into the rhythm of the land here.
Right. So place is a big part of the book because it does take place in the Applegate Valley. And it feels like an extension of myself, the land and our farm. And so I've always been one to find comfort in nature and wildness. And so I lived rurally for a long time in Santa Cruz, California, and then in Montana as well. And so when we finally settled in the Applegate Valley, we knew that we wanted to be rural. And so, yeah, it's always been kind of a part of my identity, and that's something I explore in the book as well.
So in the process of getting in tune with the rhythms of the land, did you reach some conclusions about the natural rhythms of people and love and sex?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think the correlation or the connection I can make is that the temporary nature of both the seasons and also the temporary nature of love and how it shifts and changes. And I think that's where I could make the connection. And I think that's kind of still where I stand, is it's everything's always moving, always changing, always temporary. And that's where sort of relationships and love and sex also have a lot of relationship to the land and nature. So that's how I would answer that
question. So you sought some validation for the way you were feeling in biology, and it seems like you go on for maybe more than one essay about, you know, the loons mate like this and cormorants mate like I'm making up species names here, but the fact is that there's a lot of different creatures mentioned there, but also in literature? I mean, mm-hmm. you look for examples in literature. Did you mm-hmm. find something that rose above all others and giving you something to grasp onto, either in biology or in literature?
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to always look for answers in nature. And so that's where I was looking to animals to tell me whether animals were strictly monogamous or not. I mean, I end up finding out that the flatworm's really, truly the only one that remains monogamous. I won't give away too much about that chapter, but and in literature, I looked a lot towards feminist thinkers and writers from Simone de Beauvoir, but mainly I have in the book, I discovered this Russian intellectual, Andreas Louis Salame, who was actually a lover of Rilke's and Freud's, powerful woman. And I was reading her love letters with Rilke during the time that I was writing the book. And so a number of the chapters are actually letters to her, and investigating her own sort of relationship with she had many open relationships and lovers, and so I was looking to her as kind of a model for what I might do. And the same with like Simone de Beauvoir, Edna St. Vincent Millay, some of these like free-thinking, intellectual, intelligent women from the past were kind of my model. And so they're referenced throughout the book.
You certainly sent me in search of more information. I wanted to refresh my memory on Rainer Maria Rilke, and ended up discovering he died fairly young, like 50 years old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
All right, and in 1925 or so. The book is called Tracing the Desire Line, a memoir in essays, Melissa Mathewson's ruminations on love and marriage and commitment and how people might need other things over time. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Melissa will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland Thursday evening at 7. She's here now on The Exchange. So you met Josh, and you paired up fairly young.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I met Josh when I was 18 at UC Santa Cruz, and then we were friends for several years until we became romantic, and we settled into a relationship when I was 21, and got married when I was 28, kind of went on that path of having kids, doing that, and so, you know, if you think about it, being in my 40s now, how much change occurs in oneself over a period of time, and how do you how do you rectify your changes of yourself and your identity within this long-term partnership, especially if needs change, desires change, and where does growth happen? And that's really what this book was investigating is, as I was changing, how could I stay within this marriage while also changing and becoming a different person?
After 14 years together, how break it to Josh?
How did I break it to Josh?
Yeah, and I should point out, there were kids too, two, 5 and 2 at the time.
Uh-huh, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, who are now 12 and almost 9. So I just brought it to him. It was likely, I think there's a chapter in the book where I describe when we actually discuss opening the marriage as an alternative to what we'd been doing. It was me. It was definitely, I brought it to him, and I did everything from reading all the books that are out there and trying to understand how to actually move forward with this. It wasn't met with excitement. And so that's where some of the book kind of outlines that story. And definitely, you know, it's it feels interesting to put this out there only because sort of these alternative relationships, there's definitely stigma around them. So it was something that we were privately doing, and we didn't necessarily talk with our community about opening. So, yeah.
And we have an email already from Becca in Lane County, who says, to me, having one relationship before I was widowed was as much as I could handle. I can't imagine dealing with multiple people in any capacity. Did that thought cross your mind?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a lot of emotions to juggle, right? And that's probably the biggest challenge of it is the emotional sort of roller coaster from being involved with multiple people, although the nature of those relationships are different, right? So if you're with someone who's longer, you know, you've been with someone for a long time, your nature of your relationship's different with someone who you've just met. And so how you balance those emotions between the two, I think, is the most challenging. Although the comparison I like to think about is like you have multiple friends, right? So we all have very close friends, multiple relationships, and we seem to be able to handle those. And for me, I feel like we have the opportunity in terms of romantic partners to have this term that I came across recently, which I've just held on to, is multi-love, and being able to have multiple love relationships. But it's not easy. There's a lot of time that goes into it.
No doubt. But yeah. You're talking about it as multi-love, but there's a very clear sentence of clarity in one of the earlier essays that says this isn't about love or not love. So what is it?
At the time for me, that's a quote. That's actually a quote that people quote a lot. For me, it was an investigation of self, like a deep investigation of self, and getting to know myself by exploring desire with another person, and having not been in many relationships and only with one person, there was a sort of mystery and curiosity there. And so at the time, it wasn't about not loving Josh. It was about more than that, more of an identity and investigation of self. So.
But, I mean, you knew Josh well enough after 14 years to know a good bit about his way of thinking. And so how much did you process on his behalf the kinds of things that he would be thinking when you finally said, here's what I think I want?
We're very close. So it was something that we had many conversations about. So, I mean, that's the other thing is that it brings you closer. It brought us closer because we were actually emotionally intimate in a way that maybe we hadn't been for a long time because we were really discussing some of these deep romantic issues. And I definitely thought about how he might react. And, you know, it was a process and conversation, and it wasn't easy. And the book talks about that.
How much did this set of circumstances, I hesitate to call it a crisis because I don't know if you think of it as a crisis, mm-hmm. but I mean, how much did it mirror anything you might have seen from your own parents when you were a kid?
That's a really great question. I mean, I guess it was, you could call it, I call it more of a opening, more of a, and then it led to rupture eventually. And the book talks about that. And then the book comes back to the return and the reconciliation. But I feel like I was most definitely influenced by sort of the marital patterns I'd grown up with. And whether that was conscious or unconscious, I don't know.
And positive or negative, too.
Or positive or negative, but I definitely feel like I had, you know, we are all influenced by our family structures growing up, and that definitely had an influence, I think, on sort of my investigation into whether marriage could work for me any longer.
So that's looking back a generation. Then you also have the responsibility to look forward a generation because you got kids in here, too. And how much did you think about how to break this to them, how to explain this to them, how to change your family structure in a way that would still make them be healthy.
Right. You know, we didn't talk to them about it. They were so young at the time that we didn't talk to them about it a lot. Though as they grow older and they're starting to, like my son, investigate their own sort of what they think love might look like or what marriage might look like, we have a lot of conversations about alternatives. And I open them up to that. And I hope that I'm not giving them just one model, like you have to get married and this is how you have to do it. Instead, you know, you can have multiple partners or you can have same-sex partners or, you know, so I'm trying to make sure that they have, unlike what I was given one way, I'm trying to give them more of an alternative. Here are the different ways you can be in relationship. Find what works for you. So,
the book is called Tracing the Desire Line, a memoir in essays. It's the work of Melissa Mathewson, who is a Rogue Valley-based writer and instructor at Southern Oregon University. We have much more to talk about the book, and you can join us by phone and by email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Melissa, and you can join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Josh, your husband, was fairly hurt when you said you wanted to open up your marriage. So how did you move from that stuck point, though, where you wanted something that he didn't particularly want?
A lot of conversation, a lot of providing research or, you know, books and articles on it, and a lot of making sure he felt secure, because that's definitely something that comes up is jealousy and insecurity when your romantic partner is interested in somebody else. So it was a lot of conversation, a lot of emotional processing, and reading things together and talking about them. And that's kind of how we got there until he had a moment where he kind of switched on and was ready for it.
There's a real, okay, let's try this moment in the book. And it starts out a little comedic up to a point. And I'm going to ask you to read this part. This is the beginning of chapter 11 in Tracing the Desire Line.
Okay. It's called Of Opening. It's likely Josh and I were sharing a cocktail when we decided to open our marriage. Tequila, ice, and lime. We'd been together for 14 years, married for 9. We had a farm, 2 children, and I thought, instead of cheating, maybe we could explore sex with others if we talked about it openly, if we didn't hide, which is what it seemed to me the majority of couples did. He reluctantly agreed to think on it. I went about sending him articles, buying books, talking to friends. I was determined to convince him this was a good thing to do. I wanted it badly, more than him. One day he returned home from dropping Everett off at school and he smiled, told me, "I know who I want to pursue." C was the 4th grade teacher at Everett's rural charter school, thin, petite, athletic, beautifully innocent face. She attended my gym, and I'd often see her come down the stairs from morning yoga with a look of bright ecstasy. She was farm girl pretty. She was freshly showered pretty. I really tried not to hate her. That was the deal Josh and I had made. No jealousy, no hate, all trust, all openness. That word, open, as in exposed, without secrets, without shame, public. Josh transformed into a nervous schoolboy around C, crumbling into incoherence without poise. I'd never seen him like that. The man I loved and married was confident, critical, determined, a workhorse. These characteristics part of my attraction to him. To watch him fall apart over a woman, not me, was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. I felt a mixture of fascination and envy.
So at that point, were you having a sense of wow, what have I started up here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, driving home from that picnic, I remember quite clearly, like, feeling that mixture of jealousy and what it meant for my husband to want somebody else, and then sitting sort of with my own insecurity and trying to understand it and processing those emotions, and then also just curious about where it would go and what would happen. I don't know if that's just my character. I don't know if everyone can do that, but I have this ability to kind of just think about things deeply. And so, yeah, I definitely had this moment where, like, oh, where are we going with this? That was a mixture, like I said, of both jealousy and also curiosity. So,
grab your headphones. We have a phone call for you. Let us bring in Madeline in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Melissa Mathewson, the author of Tracing the Desire Line. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I've been in a marriage that's been, you know, been marriage pretty much since for almost 49 years, and we are deeply in love, more than ever, and it's gone through various times and trials, and I think there isn't one set pattern with that kind of marriage. For me, I really don't want to know much about what or who he might be with other than me, because it would make me feel very insecure and upset. So that was, the agreement was that we would keep any other outside lovers to ourselves and really share a lot about that in the marriage, but that we would, that owning another person is different than loving another person. And that sex is more like finding somebody that sex outside of marriage is just a lot of fun. It's like finding somebody who you might really enjoy dancing with. Maybe your husband doesn't like to tango and you like to tango. Would you give up a kind of dance in order to, you know, and deprive yourself of dancing with any other partner than your husband? Of course not. It doesn't make sense. So we chose to dance with whoever we wanted to dance with, but to raise a family and to be in love and to be committed most deeply to each other. I mean, that's kind of, I think sometimes because I was adopted, the idea of being chosen rather than by law imprisoned in a relationship was more important.
All right, Madeline, thank you for sharing the thoughts. It's a very interesting story. I very much appreciate hearing that. And so what runs you through your mind, Melissa, when you hear this?
I would absolutely agree with everything that she said. I mean, there's different ways to have a long-term partnership, especially if you take lovers outside of your marriage, and whether you disclose what is happening or you don't, we chose to tell each other about the experiences, and that brought us closer, and sometimes it pushed us apart. But I absolutely agree that I think what is most fascinating to me about non-monogamy and polyamory and open relationships is the deep possibility of emotional connection and physical connection with a number of different people. Like, it's a possibility, right? And how can that deepen our sense of our own selves and give us growth, spiritual growth, emotional growth? And if you choose to stay in love with one person over 50 years, which, congratulations, that's amazing, Madeline, then I think that's beautiful too. So thanks for sharing your story.
Yeah, very much. It's was a great phone call to get. We now you've already alluded to where things went. You said it brought about a rupture. I don't want to get too detailed on the conclusion, but I mean, clearly, over the process of deciding that you wanted something other than what you had in a monogamous relationship, you thought about things great and small. I mean, not just the biology and literature stuff we talked about earlier, but concepts like home and of. I mean, was your brain fairly on fire at times?
Yeah, I think my brain's on fire a lot. But definitely during this time when I was experimenting and investigating all of these ideas, I mean, that's why the writing was so important to me, because I was writing through it all. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give away the ending. I mean, the book is a question to me. Like, that's how I kind of look at it, and that's how it's an offering, I think, to readers, is just a question and a conversation starter, and hopefully there's something that readers can get that's beautiful from it, or transformative, or something that's emotionally resonant, and that's what's important to me. And but yeah, I mean, I was investigating all senses of who I was, from being a mother, from being living in place, music, all of these aspects of who I was, centered in this investigation of marriage. So there was a lot going on.
It's interesting you refer to it as a question, though, so not an answer. So people who are like looking for, well, this is going to work for me or not, you know, they're not going to get that from this book. They're going to hear your experience.
Yeah, no, they're not going to get answers. It's definitely a question. And it's still a question, you know, something I'm still investigating in my own life. And I don't want to tell you what the last line is on the radio, but yeah, it's open-ended.
So speaking of radio, you mentioned earlier you're a DJ. I had worked as a DJ, and in fact, one of your attractions you mentioned was to a coworker at the pirate radio station. Is the pirate radio operation still on? Do you wish the FCC weren't listening to this?
So I feel okay about writing about the pirate radio station because it is no longer. And I tried to write about it because I wasn't supposed to disclose the location, obviously, of where it was. I tried to write about it in the book. book in such a way that it felt like I protected that collective.
You said a trailer in the Applegate Valley, which you know, describes a lot of places.
Yeah, that's a lot of places. You'd have to go to nearly every property out there. So yeah, that was the person that I got involved with outside of my marriage was a fellow DJ. And it was a collective of anarchists, so there was already this sort of sense of rebellion and subversion that was a part of, obviously, in pirate radio. So it kind of went along with everything that was happening in my life at the time. Yeah.
But that is a common theme then. So, I mean, questioning the rules of radio, questioning the rules of marriage. I mean, you get to a place where it sounds like you're willing to ask questions about the existing structures of being.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's what we should always be doing. And as critical thinkers and human beings in general is question all the norms that are presented to us and find alternative ways of being. So, and that's kind of what this book is and was and continues to be for me, I guess.
Do you share these essays with students?
You know, I got that question recently, and I'm pretty open about my writing, and students are welcome to read anything. I mean, I have a website. It's all public. I hope they'll read the book if they're interested. I hope they'll be inspired. I don't hesitate, really, from putting out the work, even though it's very... I guess, subversive and different and under the radar. So I don't know, if I was an undergraduate and I had a professor, I would be pretty psyched that they wrote this book. But that's me, so.
Let's talk about the literate home you found. I mean, you said you ended up sort of in the realm of the feminist writers. Mm-hmm. And so is open relationship a feminist thing per se, or is it more of just a humanist thing, considering what humans might want that differs from from societal structures?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you can be a feminist and also stay in a long-term marriage if that's what you want. I don't think it's necessarily a feminist situation. I think it, like you said, you're pointing out, it's a human situation. We all have desire. We all have questions about our norms and marriages.
But does it enter the feminist realm because of the fact that for a lot of its history, marriage is more a case of ownership?
Yes. And that's definitely the case
for the male upon the female.
Yes, exactly. And that's definitely the case that I make in the book, that marriage has typically been this model for ownership and property taking. And so subverting that paradigm as a woman is important to question those norms and for empowerment. So yes, that's definitely a key point of the book as well.
Anne in Grants Pass sent an email. Just curious. I know many birds are said to be monogamous, but are really socially monogamous and do have sex with others, yet raise their young with the mated pair. But you said the flatworm was the only monogamous animal. What about the prairie vole and black vulture? I have read the vole will even attack another female other than the first one he had sex with. I think the black vulture will attack another male who may be straying. This from Anne in Grants Pass. How great did your biological research get?
Yeah, I do actually mention the prairie vole in here, so I'm glad that the listener brought that up. I'm trying to find the place in there where I talk about it. But the last piece, I'll just read it really quickly. Do we have time?
Just a couple seconds.
No, okay.
Really.
So my thing was, there is one truly sexually monogamous animal, the flatworm, who attaches itself to its partner for life. But this isn't a solution, is how I say it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did do some deep research about animals, and exactly what that listener said is right on. So I know we're running out of time.
You learn a lot, but this is not, as you pointed out, a book where people are going to get a definitive, like, well, it's right for you if these circumstances present. It's just, you got to make up your own mind after
yes.
you read this sort of thing. It is Melissa Mathewson's book, Tracing the Desire Line, a memoir in essays. Melissa Mathewson, an essayist and teacher at Southern Oregon University. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. So this is it for the Jefferson Exchange for today. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on The Exchange. Don't forget, Melissa will be at Bloomsbury Books on Thursday evening at 7. Have a great day. California's Regions Rise Together begins Wednesday's Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk about sustainable and equitable economic growth. Later in Hour 1, equity and diversity on campus with Southern Oregon University's new officer. In Hour 2, Paul Theroux talks about his latest book on the Mexican border. That's on Wednesday's Jefferson Exchange. This morning's program airs again from 8 to 10 this evening on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.
Welcome to As It Was, Tales from the Mythical State of Jefferson. A frequent stopping place in the 1800s for travelers moving north into Trinity and Siskiyou counties was located at Cottonwood, California, between Red Bluff and Old Shasta. Among the travelers were freight and immigrant wagons, pack trains, foot travelers, and miners. Most immigrant wagon trains chose the Nobles Road Route, leaving the Oregon-California Trail via the Humboldt Sink at the Lassen Meadow Cutoff, then on to Honey Lake Valley, and continuing north of Manzanita Lake toward Cottonwood. By 1850, there was a primitive road between Red Bluff and Shasta, while the roads south of Red Bluff to Marysville were in much better shape. Stations along the route provided resting places. With steamboats unloading freight at points along the Sacramento River, the stations were conveniently spaced to accommodate pack trains and freight wagons. The five stations between Red Bluff and Cottonwood were named 2 Mile House, 4 Mile House, 9 Mile House, Prairie House, and Taylor's Ranch. From the popular Prairie House, the road wound down toward the Taylor Ranch and then to the Clanton Brothers Station, established in 1849. Today's episode of As It was written by Gail Fiorini Jenner, edited by Kernan Turner, and produced by Raymond Scully. I'm Shirley Patton. As It Was is a co-production of JPR and the Southern Oregon Historical Society. To share stories or to learn more about this series, visit asitwas.org.